Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know how I always say Google want to take over the world? Yeah, I was wrong. It's Facebook doing the taking over. Media and social media on the program today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 24th of March. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The social media beast that is Facebook is said to be in talks with a handful of major publishers, think the New York Times and BuzzFeed, about hosting their news stories directly on Facebook so that users wouldn't have to click on a link and then wait the 8 or so seconds it takes for the story they want to read to load. Details are scarce, yet it must be said, even the New York Times company wouldn't comment to its own reporters for this story. But the basic idea seems to be that while you're looking at pictures of your friend's new baby, you could also seamlessly get the latest news about the Iran nuclear talks or a BuzzFeed listicle, if that's your thing. No judgment. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at what's in the rumored deal for each side.
Facebook needs the news. But the news really needs Facebook, says Ken Doctor. He's a media analyst for Newsonomics and recently surveyed how much traffic Facebook sends to media sites. In short, tons.
This is a dependent relationship. And Facebook has been the number one social referral source for newspaper companies.
So if publishers could cement their relationship with Facebook, plus get a share of advertising and access to data on Facebook's users, Doctor says that'd be a deal worth making. But there's still lots of risks and lots of questions, says Joshua Benton, director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard.
Paywalls, how are you going to navigate charging for content in one form and having it free on Facebook? How publishers are going to differentiate themselves so that a BuzzFeed story looks like a BuzzFeed story and a New York Times story looks like a New York Times story?
Basically, it all comes down to this.
Do you give up control in exchange for a bigger audience?
Facebook has 1.4 billion monthly users. Aaron Kessler, an analyst with Raymond James, says it needs to keep those users happy and on its site or app, not waiting for some outside news link to load.
They already have the user base, so at this point it's not about adding a lot of new users, it's about engagement.
Kessler says happy users stay on Facebook longer, and that makes for happy advertisers, too. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
If you remember the financial crisis of 2008, I know, how could you forget? You no doubt remember four little words, too big to fail. The idea that some financial firms are so big and so interconnected that we'd have to bail them out and keep them alive to avoid hurting everybody else, meaning like the whole economy. That didn't sit too well with the Congress of the day, so the Dodd-Frank financial reform law requires those banks to write what have come to be called living wills that would let them die safely and quietly and harmlessly. I bring all that up because three banks, the Royal Bank of Scotland, HSBC, and BNP Paribas, have now been told their living wills aren't good enough. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn explains why not and why those things are so hard to write anyway.
For a person, a living will is a legal document that spells out what doctors should do to keep you alive and when to pull the plug. For a bank,
it's more how to pull the plug.
Oliver Ireland is a financial services lawyer with Morrison & Forrester. He says it's a roadmap of what to do after a bank dies. The idea is it'll be safer for the rest of us if they've made it clear to regulators and to themselves exactly how their many businesses work and how to safely wind them down.
Is this going to solve all the problems? Probably not, but if you thought about it ahead of time, you're going to be in a lot better shape than if you haven't.
More than 130 financial institutions have submitted living wills, but in the case of the three singled out yesterday and the 11 largest banks flagged last August, regulators said the plans weren't good enough. Mike Consall at the Roosevelt Institute says they got dinged for not fully mapping out their business's interconnected webs of financial assets.
What the FDIC and the Fed said is essentially you have not done enough analysis to give real understanding of what these exposures look like.
And those exposures are what could let a few toxic assets infect the rest of the economy.
And those are exactly the kinds of things we learned were important in 2008 and exactly the kind of things we want to regulate.
One reason some banks have fallen short on their analysis, according to Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, is that bankers don't have an incentive to save the economy. Their stock options will be worth more if they get bailed out.
So they have a stake in having a muddy or bad or not credible living will.
The banks will get another chance when they submit their new living wills by the end of this year. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Speaking of Wall Street, the day in stocks started well enough, didn't make it much past lunch, though we'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama met with the new president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, at the White House today, a meeting of which there is substantive news to report. The United States is now going to keep about 10,000 troops in country through the end of this year. That's about twice as many troops as the White House had been planning on until not too long ago. With that in mind, a story now about defense contracting in a time of defense drawdowns. Right now, the Army's official handgun is made by Beretta. But that contract is up for only the third time ever, which makes it quite the opportunity for gun makers. Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons has that story.
When Beretta won the Army's contract back in 1985, it was something of a coup for the Italian company. Up to that point, it was best known for making boutique hunting rifles. Its Accokeek, Maryland headquarters is where the Army's M9s have been manufactured since 1987. At the height of the Army contract, it employed around 500 people, but today it's about 300. Around the factory floor, the iconic form of the gun takes shape as giant machines mill hunks of steel into frames. And workers screw in the individual components by hand. Gabriel DiPlano is Beretta's VP of Military Marketing and Sales. He says when they won the contract, the impact was immediate.
Law enforcement agencies started to adopt the Beretta M9 or the equivalent commercial version. A lot of state police agencies adopted the M9. The civilian market all of a sudden took a greater note of our products.
But the Army's new request for proposals for a modular handgun system is a sign that the military isn't satisfied with the M9. There are some well-known complaints. Its magazines get stuck in hot, sandy environments like Iraq, and its grip is too big for those with small hands, like women soldiers. So Beretta updated its M9 with some new features.
So the M93 is the latest and greatest generation of M9 pistols. The pistol itself operates this exactly the same way, which is one of the advantages. If you know how to shoot this pistol, you know how to shoot the new pistol, our new M9A3.
Beretta submitted this new version, the M9A3, as an engineering change proposal to the existing contract. It fixed many of the well-known complaints about the gun. But the Army didn't bite.
We haven't given up, though. We're going to keep on proposing it as a solution.
So essentially, the Pentagon has thrown open the doors to industry-wide competition. Brian Friel, a government contracts analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence, says it's no wonder Beretta is trying to keep its contract. It's about more than the money.
The value of a government contract is beyond its nominal dollar amount because there's something of a good housekeeping stamp of approval that comes with the Army or another major agency picking your gun as the one that it's going to put in soldiers' hands.
That nominal dollar amount is actually low in the grand scheme of Pentagon acquisitions. The Department of Defense has only spent about $400 million over the 30-year life of the Beretta contract. Contrast that with the overall civilian gun market in America, which is worth about $7 billion per year, or the hundreds of billions of dollars spent on the yet-to-be-delivered F-35 fighter jet. So companies want to win this contract not just to get the government's money, but to be the Army's gun. But this time, things are different, according to Mike Green, an analyst with Avascent, a defense consulting firm.
There are 6, 7, 8 million concealed carry holders in the country, which is a larger number than a lot of people realize. And those people are carrying a firearm. Those are regular civilians that are carrying a firearm every day.
So in a way, Green says, that's put the cart before the horse.
Interestingly, though, in this case, the consumer market may actually drive what the military chooses. The research and development is all on the consumer side.
Even if Beretta doesn't win this contract, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Its predecessor, the Colt M1911, was the Army's gun for 70 years. And to this day, it still has a devoted following. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Somalia is, and has been for more than 20 years now, a failed state. There's no real functioning government there. There's no economy to speak of. So what keeps it going? Well, if you said foreign aid, you'd be wrong. It's remittances, money sent home from relatives abroad, mostly here. Which is why it's very bad news for Somalia that the last American bank that handled those remittances stopped handling them last month. So now what happens? Marketplace's Scott Tong was in the Horn of Africa for us back in 2011. He went through his tape and he filed this report.
In the famine of 2011, even as 260,000 people were dying, money was still changing hands in the refugee camp. One man from Mogadishu set up a thriving little shop.
I sell sugar and milk, also books, batteries, and candy.
Parents still paid for their kids to attend religious school and recite scripture. A lot of the money that kept people afloat came from relatives abroad, remittances from London, Minneapolis, Virginia. Laura Hammond is an East Africa scholar at the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies.
They were able to help their relatives in ways that the larger organizations weren't able to, because they could send money in 5 minutes from Minneapolis to Baidoa.
Here's how it works. Say you live in the Twin Cities. You drop, say, $200 at a money transfer store, and that store calls its affiliate in East Africa.
Hello. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And almost instantly, the receiver gets paid. It's in advance. Now, on the back end, the actual money travels there through a bank, or used to travel. American and British banks no longer do this.
Banks have decided to exit relationships in high-risk jurisdictions.
That's bank consultant Dennis Lormel.
It's just not worth it to them. The benefit certainly doesn't meet the risk of doing business.
The key word is risk. The banks fear terror groups like Al-Shabaab in Somalia use remittances to fund their activity. And the banks fear getting busted for aiding and abetting. Lormel says the regulators are now on high alert. 3 years ago, the megabank HSBC was fined a whopping $2 billion for assisting drug lords and so-called rogue nations. And in Somalia, the reality is that some money does leak out to Al-Shabaab. Our Somali store owner explains one way the group taxes the economy.
They come to your shop and check out your items. Then they decide how much you will pay. If you're a big businessman, they'll charge you more. In Mogadishu, my tax was 50%.
It's hard to know how much Al-Shabaab gets directly from remittances. Most people assume the vast majority of transfers are relative to relative. Every year, the diaspora sends an estimated $2 billion, says East Africa scholar Laura Hammond.
In the survey work that we did in northern Somalia, about one-third of our recipients said that without remittance support, they would be unable to meet their basic food needs.
So now, with remittances stalled, will more Somalis die? Maybe not, because some of the money is still flowing underground. It's an open secret that wads of cash are hand-carried across borders. Non-armored trucks are delivering it, and there are likely more creative ways.
That's really the biggest fear, is that this will force people to engage in illegal activity. Because ultimately, if people need to choose between letting their family have enough food to eat or breaking the law, I'm afraid they'll choose to break the law.
So what's wrong with that? Well, if you take the banks out of these transfers, you take out the tracking, the transparency. And that invites terrorist money launderers, says bank consultant Lormel. He's also a former FBI special agent.
If I'm a bad guy, I'm going to be more inclined to want to move money through those guys. The knowledge that it's less likely that my activity can be traced is obviously a benefit.
So all this well-intentioned bank oversight may be backfiring. Now, there is a pilot program that hopes to bring the banks back in to the above-board remittances. As for Somalis, well, the vital remittance safety net seems to be fraying for now. And the question is, will it still be there when the next drought inevitably comes? I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
coming up.
It's this amazing opportunity to be funded to do really great and exciting work.
Artists and writers and corporate money. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 104 points today, more than a half percent, closed at 18,011. The NASDAQ gave back 16 points, 0.3%, finished at 49.94. The S&P 500 off 12 points, 0.6%, ended things at 2,091. Shares in the oil producer Whiting Petroleum tumbled 19% after the company offered 35 million new shares out there to buy. Meanwhile, Lin Energy said it wants to acquire and develop new oil and gas assets. The private equity firm Quantum Energy Partners is going to put up $1 billion to help them do that. Lin shares up nearly 3% on the day. And the chief financial officer at Morgan Stanley, Ruth Porat is her name, is soon going to become the new chief financial officer at Google. Shares in Morgan Stanley off about 0.2%. Google shares up 2.1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for February. The House Judiciary Committee holds a hearing, Wrecking the Internet to Save It, the FCC's net neutrality rule. And Sex and the City star Sarah Jessica Parker turns 50. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. I don't know if you've seen pictures of it, but I have found the driverless car I want to buy. It's the Mercedes-Benz F015, and technically, it's not even really for sale. Mercedes calls it a research car, not even a concept car, but a research car, one that cost $12 million to build. The company figures something like it will be ready for market in about the year 2030. When they do eventually get here, and they are coming, driverless cars are going to change a whole lot of things. Like, for one, who's going to pay the insurance? Because if I'm not driving, why am I paying? And better yet, are we even going to need insurance? Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that story.
The auto insurance industry is doomed, at least if you ask Donald Light. He researches the impact of technology on insurance for the consulting firm Solent.
The overall size of the automobile insurance industry over, say, a 10-15-year period is definitely going to shrink.
At last count, auto insurance premiums totaled about $200 billion a year. Light says when lots of cars are driving themselves, roads will be safer, there will be fewer accidents, and that means fewer injured drivers and less need for repairs, replacement parts, and roadside assistance.
The amount of losses are going to be a lot less, and the premiums are going to be a lot less.
He says the industry could end up as much as 50% smaller. To all of this, Michael Berry says, nonsense.
As long as you own a vehicle, there's always going to be a need for some sort of liability insurance.
Barry is a spokesperson for the Insurance Information Institute, an industry group. And he says even if drivers need less insurance in the future, car makers will need more.
I mean, there's product liability insurance today, but it will take on added importance for the manufacturers of self-driving vehicles if, in fact, they become the target of lawsuits as time goes on.
If, for instance, a software defect or a malfunctioning sensor is found to be the cause of an accident, Jeffrey Bletcher says the industry is already adjusting its business model. Bletcher is with Agero, which provides driver data collection to auto insurers to find new ways of assessing risk and figuring out how to price premiums.
The whole concept of usage-based insurance is actually understanding driver behavior and driver risk. But when you get into a semi-autonomous car, what are you assessing? Are you assessing how the car drives?
Or if your smart car is smart enough? Those are among the questions Bletcher says the industry must answer, and soon. Because while fully automated cars are still a ways off, partially autonomous cars are hitting the road. Tesla has added an autopilot feature. Mercedes, BMW, and Volvo have some automation. So will Cadillac, Ford, GM, and Nissan in the next few years.
And what we don't know is, do these systems actually improve safety or not? That's one of the fundamental questions.
Actually, some people do know.
We've been working on this problem for about 20 years.
That's Neville Stanton. He researches the safety of car automation at the University of Southampton in the UK.
It takes drivers five times as long to respond in emergency in a fully automated vehicle as it does in a manually controlled vehicle.
That's in a vehicle that drives mostly on its own, at least some of the time, versus my 2001 Toyota Camry. Stanton says newer but semi-autonomous cars, ones with collision and lane departure warnings, blind spot monitoring, actually are safer.
So the driver's still manually in control of the vehicle, but the automation's been there to support them in that driving task. So it's not taking over the driving task.
The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety says if those support systems were in every car, they'd eliminate nearly a third of all crashes. Donald Light, our doomsayer, says the real blow to the insurance industry will depend on how popular automated cars become.
The critical issue really is the percentage of all cars, all vehicles on the road that have these technologies.
And a world without drivers is still a long way down the road. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
There's a thing happening in the corporate world right now that's a bit more culturally enriching than just buying another business jet or figuring out a new executive compensation plan. Companies sponsoring artists and writers to do their art and to write. Elizabeth Segrin writes about it in the new Fast Company magazine. Elizabeth, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
We should say at the outset that artistic sponsorships, you know, sort of writ large, it's not a new concept. I mean, you know, people have been doing this forever.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question of how artists, writers, and musicians are going to be able to make a living has just kind of been an age-old question. And for most of history, there's been this idea of patronage. Mm-hmm. So in ancient times, large institutions like the church or the aristocracy would support artists. But in the modern era, that sort of shifted. And around 1900 in the U.S., a new kind of support of artists came about, and that was this kind of residency concept.
And now we have, as you write in this piece, corporations, everything from Autodesk to Facebook and Siemens and Amtrak, for crying out loud, doing this, offering these residencies.
Yeah. It's a really interesting kind of shift. And now Facebook has an artist residency. It's just kind of taken over.
The interesting thing, though, I mean, there are so many different variations on this. And the contrast between Amtrak and Facebook, I think, is fascinating. Amtrak, well, tell us a story. I mean, it started with one of their social media people.
So Alexander Chi, this writer, pointed out how much great writing he gets done on trains. And so he tweeted about this, and he said, oh, wouldn't it be great if Amtrak did a residency?
Right.
And little did he know that the entire Amtrak social media team was listening in, and they thought, hey, this is a really great idea. And from their perspective, it seemed like a really great way to draw attention to the, you know, the kind of historical idea of people being able to write, you know, being very productive on trains. So this was kind of like a large-scale publicity stunt.
And you contrast that with Facebook, which is secretive is probably a kind word. Apparently there's one guy there and you have to know him and know the secret handshake to get this gig.
Well, yeah, I think that the difference there is that with Facebook, it's more of a commissioning process. It's more an opportunity to support artists by buying their work. So having an artist come and spend a couple of weeks to a couple of months building a piece of art that will live on the Facebook campus, it just seems like another way to support the artists and art.
Do you suppose there's a chief financial officer at Autodesk or Siemens or Amtrak or Facebook saying as they look over their books, now how do I justify the money we're spending on this art thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they are thinking about it in practical terms. But a lot of the times, there's actually a very useful payoff. So with Autodesk, which is a company that produces software that engineers and architects use, they bring in these artists and they give them a stipend and they give them access to all of this equipment and they even pay for their materials. Huh. But it's really actually very beneficial to Autodesk because it allows them to see these very creative people pushing technology to the
right.
very limits of what it can do. So I think that when that person with, you know, who's wearing the, you know, the chief financial officer hat is looking at this, they're thinking, well, actually, this is very good for us. This is actually helping us in some ways. And for the artist, they're thinking, this is great. I'm contributing to the production of this software that could be actually very useful to artists as well.
Is that where these writers and sculptors and whoever gets these residencies, is that where they come down that, listen, this is an opportunity for me to do my thing. I don't care if it's a corporate marketing stunt?
Yeah, I think in all of these cases, the companies are not hiding what their motives are and what they stand to gain from it. You know, if they're on site and using the equipment, they get to keep you know, the rights to their work, and that's really important. And in most of these cases, that's exactly what they're getting. And so for them, it's this amazing opportunity to be funded to do really great and exciting work.
It's a piece called Welcome to the Brave New World of the Corporate-Sponsored Artist. It's in Fast Company magazine. Elizabeth Segrin wrote it. Elizabeth, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, which comes to us from the brand new presidential campaign of Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Senator Cruz, as you may know, has been a vocal and active opponent of the Affordable Care Act. The senator himself and his family had until yesterday gotten their health insurance through his wife, a managing director at Goldman Sachs. Mrs. Cruz is now on unpaid leave during the campaign, which means, as the senator told the Des Moines Register today, that he and the fam are going to be signing up for Obamacare.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And with that, we are out of here. The Dow off 104 points today. That's more than 0.5% for the blue chips. The NASDAQ gave back 16 points, about 0.3%. The S&P 500 off 12 points, 0.6%. Caitlin Ash, Millie Jefferson, and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. Nishat Kurwa is our senior digital producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will be right back here tomorrow. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.